Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show, aliveandkicking at newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, Barbara Brennan on pouring her personal experience into her profession, working to change mental health matters. Barbara is a very special speaker on mental health, so I can't wait for you to hear from her. And Chef Louise Lennox on how, when her love of food didn't quite transfer to her toddler who refused to eat, she found her purpose in life, retraining as an accredited fussy eating therapist. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, this week I slipped back into my normal way of life, which was lovely, after a couple of weeks of lots of work, routine all over the place, food all over the place, no real exercise to speak of. After taking the weekend to just rest and reset myself and get a bit of decent food in the fridge, I was able this week to work at my own pace, catch up at the laptop, head to the gym, meet friends for a swim or a coffee, and the weather kind of topped it all off. Sorry if it wasn't sunny where you are, but I have been really loving the whole Indian summer situation that we had. And I was in Galway for the self-care sessions with VIP magazine that I mentioned, and I'm still thinking of the many people I met. I met a lady who had just had surgery for a brain tumour, and she said she was stepping off the treadmill of life and doesn't want to go back to the fast pace she was running on. Fiona Coleman-Morgan was one of the speakers at the event, and she has also had a diagnosis that shook her life. She's now living with breast cancer. And she also spoke about trying to live life to the fullest and reassess everything. And living life to the fullest is really all any of us want to do when it comes down to it, isn't it? My stress levels have been up, I must say. Back to school, a teenager with learning challenges, struggling with the secondary school system, and not struggling enough, I'd have to say, with the socialising aspect of his new life chapter. So it has had me in a bit of a spin at times, but you just have to take your time with it, let things be. I tended, when I look back, to panic and self-doubt through most of the parenting stages. So I'm trying to just mind myself and repeat the mantra, this too shall pass. You can email the show, aliveandkicking at newstalk.com. Now, Barbara Brennan poured her personal experience of mental illness into her work with Sea Change, working for many years with the organisation to remove mental health stigma in the workplace and championing their Green Ribbon campaign. She has since gone on to set up her own business, Mental Health Matters, specialising in working with organisations around mental health policy, procedures, strategy, training and changing culture. She's worked with On Post, Irish Life and IBEC, among many others. Barbara remains at the forefront of changing the conversation around mental illness and health, and she joins me in studio now. Well, Barbara, you're very welcome.
Good morning.
And we did meet many years ago. I'd only just started, and it was absolutely gorgeous at Bloom.
That's right.
At the garden, the mental health garden, and I got to hear your story. So I'm sure if people want to get your background a little bit more, they can go and listen back to that.
Absolutely.
So it's been a while and a lot has happened in the 5 years. And I wanted to start by asking you about the mental health conversation and how much has that really changed? Because I do often say on the show, we are talking about it more, where there's a more of an awareness, but do we really know what to do and what the next steps are?
I think that's a brilliant question. So there is the little thing of this pandemic that happened in the meantime. So what I've seen happen is that we are absolutely talking about it more. So we're seeing it on TV, we're hearing it in the media. We're even talking to each other about it more from a point of view of maybe in work, we're having conversations about feeling under more pressure, or at home, we're acknowledging some of those things. But it's still a very much out there kind of conversation, something separate than me. So we're okay to talk about stress. We're okay to talk about anxiety. We're okay to talk about depression to a degree. But then when it becomes actually it's an anxiety disorder, or you know, it's a depressive disorder, or actually, no, you know, I have bipolar disorder or schizophrenia or borderline personality disorder, or we start moving into those more severe and complex mental illnesses, people are still very afraid of that. And I think there's still huge stigma. So what I mean by stigma is stereotyping, prejudice and discrimination. The people are fearful of saying the wrong thing. They're fearful of even sometimes, I don't know what this person is going to do or what they're going to be like. I think there's a bit less of that. But people are not being open, especially in workplaces, because they're fearful of being judged and, most importantly, being treated differently, that it might impact their role or that kind of thing.
And why do you think that is? Because if somebody comes into, let's deal with the workplace, for example, or into a friendship circle and says, I found a lump, I have a cancer diagnosis, we all hold space, we're all, you know, I'm really sorry to hear that. How are you feeling? Who are you going to see? What's your treatment plan? Can I do anything? Lasagnas are coming to the door. Why aren't we the same necessarily with mental illness?
Well, for a number of years, I've said we've moved on a letter. So years ago, if we go back maybe 30 years, having cancer, there was a huge stigma around that. And now people are more understanding. There's a lot more research. But people also realise the huge human piece that happens and the difficulty that a person goes through and the challenges that they have. I think the piece about mental illness is that there's still so much unknown, and also there's been such negative connotations for years. So I think it still very much is that fear of being different, being separate, bearing in mind we're social creatures. So if we are seen to be different or we feel different, there is an innate fear in us historically. If I'm going to be outside my tribe, you know, if we go back thousands of years, if I was outside of the group and I'm on my own and I fall asleep, there's a bigger chance that I might get eaten by a lion or a tiger or a bear. Whereas if I'm with a community, somebody will be on watch. So this is built into us. And the thing is that our brains haven't changed in over 100,000 years. So that fight or flight is already there. It's still doing the same thing. It's just that we're doing it for different things now. So that fear base of I'm going to be treated differently. And that's before we start getting into our head and catastrophizing. I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to lose my friends. People are going to treat me differently. I'm not going to manage. Before we tell ourselves all those stories. And the amazing thing is that all that happens in an instant. So you can understand why, when somebody is not feeling well and they're experiencing the physical symptoms, they're experiencing the mental symptoms, and then there's this anguish and this shame and this guilt and this fear heaped on top. You can understand why people don't really want to. And then there is a part that sometimes people don't know, that maybe it's, you know, I've just been really tired for a couple of months. I don't know what's happened to my energy. My mojo's just a bit gone. I'm not really concentrating properly. I've had a back pain. My mood's not great, but that's normal if I haven't been sleeping properly. But they don't piece it together and say, well, actually, I haven't laughed in about 5 or 6 months now. And my mood has been consistently low, and actually maybe that's something I need to look at. They focus just on the individual separate physical symptoms. So sometimes even the awareness of actually this is a real thing. Mental health problems are a real thing. Anybody can experience it. So I think there's a number of different things at play at the same time.
And we do tend to just struggle on. Life is busy. Life is stressful. There's a lot going on in our own worlds and globally. So people sort of just carry on and say, yeah, well, this is just the way it is. We're quite an adaptive species, aren't we? That really surprises me, how we'll just find a workaround, whether it's a physical ailment, whether it's a mental illness, whether it's something, as you say, to not notice that you haven't laughed for 5 or 6 months. It sounds like something very, very, how would you not know? But then when you think about how much we're on a treadmill, easily 6 months whizzes by.
It does. And that's the thing, even with physical things, you know, if somebody's in pain, sometimes when they go to the doctor and the doctor starts asking them, well, how long is this been going on? How acute is it? Is it there when you wake up? Is it there when you go to sleep? People don't actually pay attention to the minute details of it. So it's the same with our mental health. We're not trained to look for it in that way. And we don't monitor it. And it's only when something goes wrong. But there is also the other side. So I mentioned about shame. There is this piece of feeling a burden. So a lot of people often feel like I'm not good enough. and this idea of actually somebody has it worse than me, so I don't want to bother anybody with this issue, or somebody else is worse off than me will need that service more. So there's so many different layers that get into this that prevent people from engaging. So this idea that actually you have to be really unwell in order to seek help, you absolutely don't. And the thing is that actually you're doing the service a favour the earlier you go, because you're less likely to need long-term help. You're more likely to recover sooner. You're more likely to have a full recovery and be able to manage whatever is going on for you. Whereas if you leave it and leave it and leave it, you could end up becoming very unwell.
And this really fascinates me, because often I think people scoff at the idea of wellness. They're like, what is this wellness woo-woo stuff?
Yeah.
And I have a talk coming up, and I was recently looking at the definition of it. And it's a condition obtained when a person achieves a level of health that minimizes the chances of them getting ill. So that's what we're trying to avoid. And, you know, it's not you're not going to pick it up at one retreat or with one supplement. There isn't a quick fix. It's lots of little things all together, and it'll all ebb and flow. But we need to start embracing those everyday things rather than trying to lean into the deep breaths, the mindfulness and the meditation when the stuff hits the fan.
That's it. Well, that's the thing. It has to be a practice beforehand, because it's like, you know, I say to people, if somebody's having a panic attack and you've never done mindful breathing before, that is not the moment to try and whip it out and go, come on, I'm going to guide you into this meditation and mindfulness session and help you breathe, you know. And in the same way, if you think about slips, trips and falls, if you're not a first aider and somebody falls and has a really bad gash, that's not the time for you to suddenly jump in and go, well, you know, I'm going to stitch you up here. We don't have those expertise, but also it's the practice. So it's this thing of, if we train ourselves, we know that repetition makes our subconscious remember things. So if we repeat these things, it makes it habit, so that when something goes wrong, we do it automatically. So it's those things that we need to practice. And also, as you said, if we can focus on how could I be at my optimum level, that's actually what well-being is. That's what wellness is. So that's where we need to be looking at. And also going back to the stigma and the shame piece, historically we have this idea that self-care is selfish. But the thing is, if I am selfless and I give of myself to everybody, then who am I? What's left if I give everything away? And I think we need to reshape where that is, to help people understand, if I do good self-care, I am twice as likely to be more supportive to somebody. And also I lead by example. I'm refilling my cup, and therefore I have more to give, rather than I'm going to run myself on empty so that eventually I can't function. I can't support that person, and probably I'm going to need some support myself. And that's before we look at getting resentful and all of that stuff. So there's so many different ways to approach this well-being topic, to say, actually, this is a matter of, if you want your life to be at its optimum level, whatever that means to you, your well-being, your physical health, your mental health, your spiritual health, your social health, your financial health, all of those things, you need to look at what you're doing and what you're practicing. And focusing on it every now and again when there's a crisis and sticking a plaster on it, that's not sustainable.
And mental illness is going to come to people at any time, because I always think it's a fine line between, you know, selling the wellness idea that, you know, we've both just attested to, and that prevention is better than cure. And also this idea of blame, that if illness comes your way, be it physical or mental, that you've done something wrong, you're not doing life right. And I met someone recently at an event, and I mean, look, it was a very positive conversation. She was a very positive person, but she had recently had surgery for a brain tumor. I mentioned it in the introduction to the show, when she said, I was on a treadmill and, you know, I'm going to really change my life. But I don't like this guilt and shame associated when something happens, that somehow we've messed up in the matrix. It'll just happen sometimes, won't it? And there won't be explanation, because, you know, children can have mental illness when perceivably they don't have any major worries going on. It can just come to somebody.
That's right. And I think the definition here as well, if we look at mental health as a topic, we all have highs and lows. We all have fluctuating moods. And the thing is that some people may experience mental health difficulties or a dip in the mood. And that could be, like you say, just out of the blue, or it could be in relation to a death or a breakup or a change in school or a change in job or something that we perceive as negative or a threat that we are challenged by. And that may be an isolated event and they may move through it and continue on with their life. For somebody who is diagnosed with a mental illness, then that's something that needs to be looked at across their lifetime. How are we going to monitor this? How are we going to manage it? And this is the thing that, you know, I was diagnosed at 14 with clinical depression and, you know, I didn't know what that was. And then I thought I had got better and then I got sick again. And then in my 20s, I got diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Now, the thing is, for the last 16 years, I've been off medication. I have been massively well and done incredible things with my life. Whether I'm cured or just preventing it, I don't know. But as long as I keep doing the preventative things and I keep doing the maintenance, does it really matter? And I think that's the bit where we need to help people understand whether somebody has a diagnosis or not. The possibility of becoming unwell is there for all of us, whether it's physically or mentally. So, for example, if I, let's say I lose my job and I'm feeling a bit low about that. And over the coming 6 weeks, I don't get out of bed on a regular basis. I don't go and do shopping. So I maybe order pizzas in. I'm staying up late and I'm watching TV loads. You can imagine what's happening to my body. So I'm not giving it proper nutrients. I'm not drinking enough water. I'm not keeping a routine. I'm not sleeping well. So obviously all of those things are going to impact our mood. And that's before we enter into any conversations about what's happening in your head, in your mind. So then when we start layering the mental aspect of it, that's when we start looking at it becoming a challenge or a more longer term thing. But the thing is that even with a mental illness and a diagnosed illness, we can still have that same positive impact. So it's understanding that if I make a choice about what I eat, what I drink, what I, how I move my body, when I go to bed, how I sleep, the interactions I have with humans, all of these little things, if I do all of them in a mindful way and I choose, more than likely it's going to improve my life. So it's those times when we feel overwhelmed and we feel that everything's out of control, but maybe we're making poor choices.
Yeah, and it's all those little things coming together.
Yeah.
And I asked you at the start of the interview about whether awareness is enough. I mean, it's a huge positive step over the decades that we've got to this point. Is it still very positive? I said it was almost like a negative. We're talking about it more. And I mentioned that you're, you know, involved. Workplaces are really getting involved. I know through my own work, I see what workplaces really interested in investing in policy. So there is more happening than we're just talking about it. But is that the first step to have this awareness, to have the visibility of the green ribbon from Sea Change in workplaces? I know you've a poster campaign. We're going to start seeing national posters about mental health. So is this a very important part of the process, that awareness is at the forefront?
Of course it is. And I think that the whole idea of campaigns like the Green Ribbon campaign or like this new national poster campaign, these things, it's to get people having normal conversations. And what I mean by that is to be able to say, well, how are you feeling? And when somebody comes back and says, oh, I'm fine or I'm grand, that we ask again. So some of those things are how we start having better conversations. And then when somebody isn't doing okay, that we've normalized feeling different feelings, because the thing is, we don't have any bad feelings. We tend to demonize being angry, being sad, being disgusted, you know, feeling low, all these things. Those emotions and those feelings are telling you something. They're not positive or negative. They're just telling you something. I don't like feeling like this. I would prefer to feel better. So in the same way, if we can have those conversations with our colleagues, with our family members, with our kids, so that we can start understanding that, and also not having to hide it, because this is the whole thing about historically mental health problems. It was this piece of, you know, she's mad and bad, you know, he's crazy, like those type of things. And it was really stigmatizing from a point of view of you're forever tarred with this thing, when actually we don't maintain the same mood all of the time. So it shifts and it changes. And this idea that actually people can and do get better and can and, you know, do go on to live incredible lives and do lots of different things. But also to understand that there's no shame in having a feeling or having an experience or going through illness. And it's about normalizing those conversations. So awareness is the first part, that people understand that it is normal to feel your feelings. It is normal to have bad experiences and to be impacted by them. It is normal to have a negative response to trauma. It is normal to struggle with your mental health if you haven't yet learned the tools in how to mind your well-being and mind your health in general. All of that makes sense when it's in that context. But when you're in the middle of it and you feel like you've suddenly got there, that can feel overwhelming. But the truth is, and it's like you said, it takes ages. It doesn't happen just overnight. But the point is that if it's taken you 6 months or a year or 2 years to get to the point that you feel, actually, I'm not managing, I'm not coping, the fix is not also not going to happen overnight. It might also take 6 weeks, 6 months or 2 years. So it's that piece of understanding that it can fluctuate and change. And the thing is, you might take two steps forward and one step back, and that's okay. So to help people understand that it's different for everybody, if somebody has a diagnosis, it doesn't mean it's going to look like what the textbook says or what somebody else has, the same illness maybe. We're all individuals, so how we respond is going to be different and what we need might be different. And I think normalising that is the bigger part of the conversation. And even bigger than that is reducing the shame and the fear.
Oh, Barbara, I love your message. It's amazing. And you're doing amazing work at Mental Health Matters. So I mentioned the poster campaign. There's going to be posters up nationwide. People are going to see them. They're all different categories: children, school, workplace. And that's going to be that conversation starter. When are they going to go live around the country?
So we have an amazing launch next week, the 24th of September in Smock Alley. So Mental Health Reform, Mental Health Commission, the HSE, Spun Out, First Fortnight and Suicide or Survive and On Post have come on board with me with this. So it's going to be available on their websites. It's going to be in lots of different places. It's going to be downloadable from the websites. There are physical copies. We also have a surprise that I'm not going to talk about. So you can go to mentalhealthmatters.ie or indeed any of the partners to find out from next week on. And the thing is that it really is, we wanted to have a really open conversation. And that's why we had all the different categories, that people from any walk in life can say, actually, I'm part of this conversation. So that's why we have the different categories that people can identify with where they are in life and say, actually, this conversation is for me too. So that's launching next Tuesday. And we also have a suite of videos that were sponsored by On Post, and they came on board and we filmed in the EXO during the summer. We had 22 amazing humans, including some kids, come in and talk to us about what they thought that we should be doing about mental health, particularly in the workplace. So all of those resources will be released next Tuesday and they will be available for free to anybody who wants to use them. And it's really just to get people to start a conversation, even by saying, hey, did you see about this thing? Or what do you think of this? Or I saw this video and I'm not sure what I think. What do you think? Or look at this kid, aren't they so cute?
Just start the conversation.
Start.
I absolutely love
start.
It. That website again is mentalhealthmatters.ie. Barbara Brennan, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, renowned chef and TV regular Louise Lennox clearly has a love of food. So imagine the stress she endured when her kids didn't seem to share this love and times with food became a real challenge. Since coming through the experience, she has retrained as an accredited fussy eating coach and she joins me on the line now. Louise, you're very welcome.
Claire, it's lovely to talk to you. What an intro.
Yes. I mean, and I think for any parent, it can be really a stressful time. I was very surprised at the instinct that kicked in to feed my kids and to give them. I couldn't even do baby-led weaning. I just needed a full bowl to go into each kid and know that that was going to fill them. It's like an instinct takes over.
I just describe it as primal. With my background in food, like food saved like my self-esteem, with me being this little shy kid in school that no self-confidence or self-esteem of being dyslexic. I have an amazing teacher standing in the class, asked me to bake cake for my homework as my reading assignment, because I was reading cookbooks. Everyone else was reading like Roy Dahl. And this instilled my confidence. And so then to go full circle, and then my son doesn't eat. I honestly felt like the worst mother ever. And the guilt just was real. I didn't speak about this in the media because I felt I would be judged, because I judged myself.
And it's really common though, isn't it? One in three children will be affected by some sort of fussy eating at some stage in their lives.
And that's globally. This is what blew my mind when, like, oh, I had two questions, Claire, when I went out on this, and I will call it a journey because I don't want to burst anyone's bubbles, but picky eating is not solved overnight. There's no quick fix, no magic wand. I thought there would be. So when there wasn't, I can honestly say it was like so sad. But when I realized what a massive problem it was, it gave me comfort, but it still didn't make me feel better because all I wanted to know was why does fussy eating even begin? And then how do you fix it? I had those two questions. And it was those two questions that started me on a very big, long path. And I never knew, being this new mother, that it would actually be a career change path for me.
So tell us a little bit about the why, because as I said, I was really motivated to give my kids a full tummy. But when I look back now, I'm not sure that was the right way to go, to allow them to intuitively regulate their own appetite and find their own way with food would probably be far better. And yet that's hard because societally we're told, you know, three meals a day, nutrition is so important, which it is. So you're trying to navigate through that. It's hard to give kids food freedom in all of that.
We're socially conditioned, and that's not in a judgmental way. I think we inherit a huge amount from our grandparents and from food scarcity, you know, like potato blight and the famine, everywhere we've come from as a nation. And I'm just not just homing in on Ireland as a nation, I'm saying about globally, is, you know, nobody wants to think their child is going to starve. And when we have an abundance of food, it's this, you know, we must fill up, and it's the hunter-gatherer. If you didn't have a full stomach, there was a chance you might get eaten when you were like this primal, you know, cave person. So it is that. And I would agree with you. I would have been the parent as well, Claire, that was like, just eat the food, finish on your plate. And it wasn't until I went back and studied the psychology of how children are and how we actually eat that it actually changed my entire take of that. But kids don't come with a parenting book. They really don't. Like, you and I as mothers know this. And it's only when a problem arises that you address it to go, oh, maybe what I did wasn't correct as to nowadays findings. But I always feel we do the best we do until we're met with a problem. And so to allow your child, now that I know, you know, fit, like, eat until they tell you they're full, that's them understanding their internal cues. But we don't know that, you know, really. And like, babies have it. And then somewhere along the way, we don't understand that. And when I say we, I'm talking about, I didn't understand this. So I would have been, clear your plate. That's part of it. But a lot of like fussy eating, it's so multi-layered. And this is what really was a huge learning curve for me, because, and that's why it's not one size fits all. Every child is different. Everybody eats differently. And it's not just what we eat, it's our environment of where and how we eat. How we eat here mightn't be how you'd eat in another country. So it wasn't an easy answer to find. And that's what I think led me further down this path, was because my son's fussy eating wasn't just what I thought was an overnight, what happened overnight. When I looked back into it with my children's feeding therapist hat on, I realized there were earlier signs I missed as a parent, as an early mother who knew nothing.
And what was life like then? Describe how challenging it got with Alex and food.
Oh, it was heartbreaking. So I went from a son that ate everything, this like baby weaning dream, to he was 20 months, and the first thing I noticed him rejecting was chicken. I had made, everything was homemade, chicken curry. And I just went, oh, that's unusual. Didn't think anything of it. And then a really fast kind of snowball effect. And he suddenly was not eating any chicken. Then there was no meat. Then all of a sudden, bar milk, there was no protein. Then fruit and veg, forget about that. And then his diet became so limited. He only ate at his worst 10 foods. And to put into perspective, I was up and down to my doctors. Like, the doctors was like a revolving door. And he was given failure to thrive because he was losing weight rapidly. And the moment, I always get upset when I tell this story because it's so raw. But the moment he was this little boy, and he came over to me and he was in a pair of
tiny little jeans, and as he ran, the jeans fell down around his ankles because he was losing so much weight. And I was his parent and I didn't know what to do.
And the language around this is so important, isn't it? Obviously, there was the physical manifestation of what was going on, and I can hear how triggering, of course, that would be for any parent and was for you. But failure to thrive, I mean, that just would strike fear in anybody's heart, as opposed to picky eater, fussy eater. There's something a lot more empathetic and understandable about that.
But he was losing weight, clearly, because it's one thing when they're on the scales, but when they're in the clothes, and it's not the clothes, they're growing out of them. Like, the clothes don't fit him. And then also he had chronic constipation, and I knew food would help, but I couldn't make him eat. And these are the three things in life as a parent we cannot force our kids. And this is fact, science fact, and it's all evidence backed as well. You cannot make them sleep. You cannot make them go to the toilet, and you cannot make them eat. You cannot force feed them. Unless you put a tube down there, you cannot do that. And so he'd chronic constipation. He was waking up during the night, unbelievably bad mood swings. Like, my happy little boy was changing rapidly before my eyes, and I didn't know what to do. My doctor didn't know what to do. And that's when I kind of went, okay, well, I busted every myth of put them on time out if they don't eat. Fussy eating kids only eat what we would deem as junk food, bribe them with desserts to eat. And it went on and on and on, and nothing worked. And the evidence also says that they don't work, but they still are massively circulated online. And this is why I went on this journey, was I just wanted to get my son to eat. And I think I was very hard on myself, because food gave me my identity. So when I was dyslexic, well, still am dyslexic, but it was the one thing that I felt good about myself. I knew that I failed my leaving, but I knew that I was good at cooking. The joke in, like, you know, the chef culinary world is you can't eat paper. So you can have all these things, but if you come into a restaurant kitchen and you can't cook, and you're probably not going to get the job. So I always knew that this was something that I felt good about myself. And then I'm doing popular TV shows, and I'm even doing children's TV shows, and I go back to college and I study diet, health and nutrition. And I've all these things that I would have thought on paper would have said, oh my goodness, you're going to have the feeding part of parenting nailed. So for my son to not eat, and I ticked every box, like, my son was breastfed. Now, he was premature, so I express breastfed, weaning, everything was made from scratch. I gave him variety. And I kept going, like, where did I go wrong? How has this happened to me? And then that's when I realized that it's not me, it's his little system. I didn't do anything wrong, but I then did learn ways that to improve the environment and to help him get better with food. And that's why it's become, I'm not making this up, Claire, I am so passionate. I wake up in the morning thinking, how can I teach them something new to eat? It's just, and I just want to help as many other people. Like, I'm so popular at, like, my friends get togethers, because they'll always come over to me with a picky eating or a fussy eating problem, because most people at some stage are affected by it. It is part of normal development for children, but then if they don't grow out of it, then it can snowball. Or there are other children like Alex that were like problem feeders, and at his worst, as I said, only ate 10 foods. And you feel it's a reflection of how you mother your child as well, because the one thing you just want to do, mammals do, is feed their young and nurture them.
Yeah. And, you know, you're right. This is something that I think most parents will have been affected by at some stage. And to hear you now coming from such a heartbreaking place with Alex in the doctor's office to where you are now, it will bring hope to parents listening at home that they can get through this. And so, as I said at the beginning, you decided to retrain as an accredited fussy eating therapist. And I want to dig into what you actually learned from that course. But before we do that, we just need to take a quick break.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
I am speaking to Chef Louise Lennox on how, when her love of food didn't transfer to her toddler who refused to eat, she has since found her purpose in life, retraining as an accredited fussy eating therapist. And so, just on that process, Louise, of what you actually learned, you've mentioned some of it and some of the mistakes you made, but what did you learn when you retrained?
So, there's a lot. So, I'm going to kind of give the most standout things. And this will just, you, this isn't even linked to food. The first thing I changed was my son's chair. And you're going to think, a chair? When we need to be posturally stable when we sit down. So most adults, our feet go, you know, are on the floor. And if you go into a restaurant or a bar and you're at a table and say they're like, you've no table and you're given the bar stool, the first thing we do subconsciously, you never notice this, you go to see where you can put your feet. And if there's no bar rest, you're actually not comfortable at all. And it's awful to sit there and eat. So his feet were dangling. So it's very distracting for kids and they can't sit and concentrate on eating. But also they're actually not posturally stable. So they're not focused on eating because they're actually focused on staying upright and keeping their balance so they don't fall and, you know, hit their head. That's all subconscious. So I got his feet. I got a little, like one of those little chairs. I got a secondhand. So his feet were like stable. I got books at one stage before I even got that to stable his feet. So he's a little bit more centered. The big thing that I removed was the pressure. We pressure kids all the time with food. When kids learn how, so eating is a learned skill. When we learn how to talk and walk, we make it fun for our kids. We sing them songs. We watch every little milestone. We make it fun. We're engaged. When it's eating, we actually, it's the opposite. We put pressure on them. We put food on the plate. If they're not eating enough, we stare at them constantly. And it's an awful environment to be in. It really is. And so those were the two big things. I had to learn how to do this. This wasn't something I just got overnight. It, like everything that I learned, I put into practice with Alex, because I'll be honest, I was training with the like pediatric feeding disorder specialist psychologists, and I was listening to it going, does that really work? And I'm glad I was able to do everything with Alex, because I would come away going, oh, I just don't know if I believe this. And then another big part that I did was I started putting structure into our meals. I learned so much about appetite. So you should really space meals out during the day, because when kids are allowed to graze, they don't actually get those hunger and fullness cues. And we've 8 senses. So 5 we know about, the obvious, you know, touch, smell, taste. I probably left 2 out. But then we've got 3 other ones of not the non-5 obvious ones. Is proprioception, vestibular, and interoception. So interoception's all got to do with your organs on the inside of your body. So your stomach being a muscle is one of them. And to allow children to actually know what it feels like to be hungry and then to feel full actually helps them with eating as well. There's so much.
That's so interesting, isn't it? And you're right. I think we've gone a bit snack crazy, particularly when it comes to kids. There's so many available on the market. Kids ask for them constantly, and we forget about going back to basics of kind of eating when hungry. But it can be complicated, as you say. How are things now in your house?
Oh, like such a turnaround. And with Alex's eating, you know, his favourite food is prawns, and he loves eating, like I make these like spinach, like homemade wraps, and it's massively changed. But I'm not going to lie to people. I'm not going to say he eats every vegetable. Like he doesn't. He's still learning about vegetables, but he'll eat a certain amount of veg. He loves fish now. Like he's a carnivore, loves meat. Like for the amount of foods that he used to eat to now, it's blows my mind. And that's why earlier, why I do feel that emotional coming through speaking with you, because it's a time in my life that seems so far removed. So when I go back to there, as you had said, it's triggering, but it is, because I think areas like that never like leave you, especially when you gather that blame and that shame and the guilt. Whereas now when I see him, I don't dread dinners, I don't dread meals, but it's actually one of those happy times when I sit down at the dinner and I don't feel like I have failed as a parent. And it's just the loveliest thing to be able to go out. We didn't go on family holidays together because I knew that he would literally starve. This year was our very first like hot Spanish, your stereotypical holiday that we actually went on. And we didn't go to family parties. Eating out in restaurants, we never did. All of these things in my food background that gave me joy, I couldn't bring on to Alex. And it just fills me with so much joy now to be able to share this with him, because like when we think about food, food is stacked with memories and the big celebrations through the year. Yes, there's certain customs, but a lot of those customs are still back to food.
And you and I met recently at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre. We were going to see Wicked, and I met Alex, and what a gorgeous, healthy, happy, confident, friendly little guy he is. And I know he has a little sister now, so I'm so glad that this was a chapter in your lives. But as you said, it's become a passion project for you now, because you want to give parents hope and other families who might be going through this advice that things can get better, and it's not down to you. It's just something that can happen to anybody.
It can happen to any. Look at me, chef with a food nutrition background, working on, you know, all the show food writing, and it happened to me. And I honestly would not have thought that at all. But and it turned into like, it's like, you know, the way you find your purpose in life. I thought like food, oh, that's my purpose. I actually now realize that learning everything through Alex and being that mother, I didn't come into this being a children's feeding therapist. I came into this from being that desperate, heartbroken mother that just wanted to help my child, to now finding this path. And it really gives me the greatest amount of joy when I can help people. And then you do hear the results and you form these bonds, not only with the parents, but with the children as well. And I can honestly say, you know, when you're filling out your well, I didn't fill out CAO forms, so I knew I was going to fill my leaving. But you know, when you're going, this is what I want to be when I grow up. I never thought that a fussy eating expert, children's feeding therapist was going to be on that. But I can honestly say, Claire, it just brings me the most amount of happiness being able to help other people.
And it all comes under the same umbrella of teaching people to love food and enjoy food, that joy of food. And you're also ambassador for the Breast Cancer Ireland Great Pink Bake Off again this year. €75,000 was raised last year, which is just incredible, because people need to come together, don't they? You can download the pack, you'll get it at breastcancerireland.com. You bake, you invite some of your friends to bake something pink, everybody gets together and you donate. So it's something nice to do with food and coming together and also raising much needed funds.
I love this because this campaign is incredible, and I feel knowledge is power. I also feel we have to educate ourselves. We can't stick our heads in the sand. Cancer doesn't really care about your background, and it can get anybody at any time, regardless of your age. And when I learned that, I did not know all of the early signs of cancer, I was actually shocked. And I kind of went, okay, I need to actually understand breast health check better. And I need to know what the symptoms are, because you could miss one, and to know that it's treatable as well. I also feel, becoming a parent, mortality is more scary, because we want to live a long, healthy life to be able to nurture our young and have them grow up and be there for all those moments. So for people to be able to bake something and meet their friends and raise some money, I also think we're still a little bit conditioned from off the back of COVID all these years later, because it's a lovely excuse for you to think, write a list, who have I not seen in ages, and let's have a little get together. And I mean, baking, I used to always joke saying you don't make friends with salads, but bake something and have people over. But they're bringing in a new part of it this year, and I just love this. And it goes full circle back to my days as a kid in school, the bake sale. There, we want schools, we want teachers, principals, anyone on parent committees to host a bake sale this year, and to get the children involved as well. Kids love baking. Kids love baking, and it's really good for confidence, for giving them an activity to do. I got my son's school, it was they didn't give kids any homework, and it was to bake something for homework last year, and they did the year before as well. And I just think it's a lovely thing to allow your kids. Now, you just have to accept that my kitchen might get a little bit messy, but you know what? You're going to give these kids this lovely memory. And we want schools to get involved this year. And to give you an idea, Claire, you're never too old to learn something. So last year, I lived my best Billy Barry life. I always wanted to be a Billy Barry kid. always envied the toy show with them tapping their hearts away. And my mum was like, we lived south side. She goes, yeah, I'm not going to drive all the way over there. So forget about it. So last year I took up tap dancing, and I brought down pink cakes and bakes to my tap dancing class, and everyone donated it. So it doesn't have to be a big thing if the thoughts of inviting people over to your house scares you, because my place is always messy. So you can actually bring them into the workplace, into some group you're part of. You like swimming, you could bring them down to the beach and hout some morning. There's always opportunities.
Oh, I absolutely love that. You just spread joy everywhere you go. I can see you handing out pink cupcakes while you tap dance. It definitely fits your personality. If people want to find out more, go to breastcancerireland.com. You can download the Great Pink Bake Off kit and help them raise much needed dough for this excellent cause. And to find out more about Louise's work with fussy eating kids, go to fussyeatingkids.com. Louise, it's been an absolute joy. Thank you for allowing us to go back to what was a tough time, but thank you for spreading the joy and love for food. Continued success. Wishing you all the best. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you, Claire.
So that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Aidan McKelvey, and to Simon Keane, and to Hugo Da Silva Scott, who was on sound. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.